made USAA insurance for veterans like James. When he found out how much USAA was helping members save, he said,
"It's time to switch.
We'll help you find the right coverage at the right price. USAA. What you're made of, we're made for." Restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Dr. Madeira Show, where he will discuss testosterone optimization and full body health for the high-performance modern man. Now, here's your host, Dr. Madeira.
How's it going, everybody? It's Dr. Sam Madeira back here on the Dr. Madeira Show, and I'm really excited to introduce our guest today, Dr. Darren Ingalls. And how are you doing today, Darren?
I'm doing great, Sam. How about yourself?
Doing really well, yeah. I'm really excited to have you on the podcast. Dr. Ingalls is a licensed naturopathic doctor and fellow with the American Academy of Environmental Medicine. He is the author of The Lyme Solution, a five-part plan to fight the inflammatory autoimmune response and beat Lyme disease. Dr. Ingalls is an expert in Lyme disease, autism, and other chronic immune disorders. And I've been reading your book. I really appreciate you writing that for everybody so that people can get the lowdown on how to deal with Lyme. And one of the things that I really appreciate is you talking about the lack of efficient testing to diagnose Lyme disease.
Right.
And you have your own story. Maybe you can share what you feel comfortable with the listeners about kind of how you got into this specialty and this niche.
Sure. Well, you know, it's funny. My very first case of Lyme disease as treating was actually when I was a resident at Baxter University in Seattle. And someone had traveled to Wisconsin, which is a state that's well known to have Lyme disease, and came back and had gotten infected. So I was thinking, oh my gosh, I saw Lyme disease. Now you hear about this in school. And at the time, you know, we really hadn't seen many cases in the Seattle area. And then after residency, I moved to Connecticut. And of course, for people who don't know, Lyme disease is named after Lyme, Connecticut. It's a city where they first discovered all these children having, you know, arthritic problems back in the late 70s. And it took them several years to figure out it was this bacteria called Borrelia that causes Lyme disease. But that's really where it sort of originated. So having been in Connecticut for about a year and a half, I was actually getting set to open my own practice. And about 2 to 3 weeks prior to opening, I got Lyme disease. I got classic Lyme disease with, you know, headache, fever, had a big bullseye rash in the back of my leg, chills, swollen lymph nodes, numbness and tingling in my hands and feet. So pretty much any symptom you read about in a classic medical text about Lyme disease, I pretty much had that. And I got treated right away. And after 4 or 5 days of antibiotics, I felt fine and proceeded to move on in opening my new practice. And, you know, for anyone who's opened their own business, they know what it's like where you're kind of doing everything. So I was, you know, the doctor and the bookkeeper and the receptionist and, you know, working very long days. And after about 8 months of keeping up that schedule, I started to relapse again and having symptoms. And I said, okay, you know, not a problem. I've dealt with this before. So I started treatment again and it didn't help. And after a month, I changed treatments to different antibiotic and it didn't help. And I went through really about 9 months of changing antibiotics using different regimens and actually got a lot worse. I lost a lot of weight. My gut was a wreck. And I was fortunate to have known of a doctor in New York City since I was very close to that area. He was a Chinese medical doctor and acupuncturist, and I had known of people who had seen him. So when I saw him, he started me on some Chinese herbal remedies. I was getting acupuncture and also just kind of coming to the realization that, you know, I need to really start taking care of myself. And after about 3 to 4 weeks of following that protocol, I was 80-85% improved. So it was really my wake-up call as a naturopathic physician that, you know, I had to go back to my roots and really start paying attention to things I had been preaching to my own patients about self-care and how important diet is and sleep. And I continued on that protocol. And it took about 2 years to feel like I really got my life back, but eventually got to a point where I was symptom-free. And I just really started applying what I had done for myself to my patients. And of course, being in the hotbed of Lyme country, I started seeing more and more Lyme patients. And, you know, fast forward, you know, 18 plus years, now treating about 6,000 Lyme patients. I've just seen that, you know, this approach seems to work much better than the conventional medical approach, which really only focuses on killing the bug and kind of ignores, you know, all these other facets of our being.
Yeah, that's a powerful story that you went through that yourself and had your own kind of healing journey or process and path. Interesting enough, I actually grew up in Vermont, probably about 200 miles north of Lyme, Connecticut. Was exposed to a lot of ticks growing up, and you know, there was the protocol to pull the ticks off, but you know, it was just like getting a mosquito bite. It wasn't anything out of the ordinary. So Lyme disease in New England is prolific, as you are very well aware of. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, what people need to understand is that, you know, it's become the largest epidemic really in the world. It's the fastest growing infectious disease in the world, including the U.S. And what we used to think was sort of isolated to New England and the central part of the Midwest, we've now learned that, you know, it's now Lyme disease has now been reported in all 50 states. Both the eastern and western seaboards are covered with Lyme. So, you know, it really doesn't matter where you are, but if you happen to be on the coast and the central Midwest, you are more at risk than other areas. But, you know, the nature of, you know, how ticks have moved away from their typical habitat, you know, via, you know, climate change, birds are now, you know, flying further than they used to. They're going to areas they didn't used to go, and they bring those ticks. We've got research that documents this. The warmer weather means that ticks don't die off in the wintertime. A lot of the natural predators that used to kill the ticks, their populations diminished. So that combination of things has really led to, you know, this tick population kind of exploding. And therefore, you know, we see more and more cases of Lyme. You know, we estimate in the U.S. it's upwards of about 400,000 new cases a year. And in Europe, it's about 85,000 new cases. So you can do the math and figure out if we've got 400,000 people each year getting diagnosed with Lyme, that's probably still underreported. You know, whether it's 500,000 or more, we don't really know. But the bottom line is that we now have millions of people, you know, walking around with Lyme, and many of them who don't know that they have it.
Yeah, thanks for sharing those statistics, because working in Seattle, Washington, a lot of the times my patients are looking at me wondering why I want to look at Lyme disease as a root cause of chronic fatigue or maybe right. some of their autoimmune-like conditions that nobody else has really looked at. And come to find out these people have vacationed on Long Island ever since they were a child or things like that. But it is everywhere, like you said now, so it's shocking. Have we established that it's in Alaska and Hawaii too, or is
yep.
You know, wow.
Yeah, we have cases that are reported there. So, you know, again, you know, some Alaskan, some Hawaiian could have traveled to another part of the country, another part of the world where they got exposed. But these are people who live in these states that get positive Lyme tests. So, you know, I don't know how diligent every state is about testing their ticks to see if they carry Lyme disease or not. You know, I think part of what's made it confusing is that there's actually several different strains of this bacteria that cause Lyme symptoms. So, you know, the testing that's out there really focuses on one of the strains. And that was the original strain we identified back in the late 70s, early 80s. And certainly that accounts for a lot of cases of Lyme disease. But knowing that the West Coast now, upwards of maybe half of these cases is a completely different strain. So if, you know, if you've gone and you've had a Lyme test and it came back negative, you know, part of it is that the test itself isn't great. It's not very sensitive and it misses a lot of people that actually have the disease, but it's also possible that they've just looked for the wrong thing and, you know, maybe you have a different strain. So, you know, I think about, you know, when I lived in Seattle and all the people that were going up in the Cascades and going hiking and, you know, doing all those outdoor activities, you know, there's lots of ticks up in that area and it'd be very easy to be exposed. But, you know, these ticks are tiny. They're about the size of a poppy seed. Even when they get fully engorged, they would be very easy to miss. They like to go to the dark, moist areas of your body. So the back of the knees, the armpit, the hairline, the groin area, and so forth. So it's in places where most people aren't looking anyway. And, you know, this telltale rash that we associate with Lyme, you know, the CDC says up to 80% of people get that rash. When you look at the research, it suggests it's probably 40% or less. And in my practice, you know, I'd say it's probably 20% or less. So for people who get that classic bullseye rash, you know, but absence of that rash doesn't exclude the possibility of having Lyme. So, you know, when people start talking about having, you know, chronic, you know, arthritic problems, joint issues, muscle pain, particularly if it's combined with any kind of neurological problem. So when you start hearing about memory loss and numbness and tingling and muscle weakness, people start complaining of feeling clumsy. They forget a lot of things. They start mixing up letters and numbers. You know, that combination of symptoms makes me very wary that, you know, Lyme or some other type of tick-borne illness might be part of the problem.
Yeah, it seems that the Western blot, is that the test that you were mentioning, the blood test that is used a lot of the times, is how many bands are they looking for in the Western blot now from the CDC's diagnostic criteria?
Yeah, the CDC's criteria is actually a two-tiered method. So the first test is a screening test, and it's a general antibody test for both IgG and IgM antibodies. So IgM is the antibody we associate with sort of acute infection, and IgG is the antibody we associate with, you know, past infection. So this is sort of a mixed antibody test. And if that test is positive, then it flexes over to what we call a Western blot, which is a much more specific test where it's testing for more antibodies. The problem with the CDC test, well, there's actually several problems. You know, some of the biggest problems, though, is that it's just not a sensitive test. And, you know, I was a microbiologist before I was a doctor. I used to work in a lab. I used to do these tests for a living, and I know a lot about them. And, you know, the problem with these tests is that any laboratory test to really be a good test will generally be at least 98% sensitive. And what that means is that if you actually have the condition, it will pick up 98 of 100 people who have that condition. So there's only a 2% error of, you know, people you might miss. Well, when you look at the research on the Lyme test, you know, it shows it's somewhere about 43 to 46% sensitive. So literally misses half the people who actually have the disease. You know, as a laboratorian, that's a problem. As a doctor, it's a bigger problem because, you know, for people who are relying on that test to make the diagnosis, you know, you're going to miss a lot of people who have it. In addition, you know, that test was really designed to test people in the acute phases of Lyme disease. So if someone, you know, missed that window, the further you get away from it, you know, immunity naturally wanes with time. So the likelihood of picking it up, you know, if you were exposed a year ago, 5 years ago, or 10 years ago, is going to be way, way less just because you're not making that same antibody response. So, you know, at the end of the day, you know, if you go to the CDC's website and you read about Lyme disease, it tells you Lyme disease is a clinical diagnosis. It really is based on your symptoms. So part of diagnosing Lyme disease is, yes, we do the test to try and see if you have a positive. If it's negative, it doesn't exclude the possibility. But, you know, because Lyme looks like a lot of other conditions, we do have to go through that process of ruling out other conditions. And since Lyme looks like a lot of other infections, it looks like an autoimmune disease like lupus and rheumatoid arthritis sometimes, you know, we have to do our diligence and rule all these other things out. But, you know, we'll hear this story over and over of people who've been sick for a long time. They're tired, they ache, they hurt. They've been to their primary doctor, they've been to the rheumatologist, and, you know, everything keeps coming back negative. And then eventually they end up in the psychiatrist because they said it's all in your head. So it's just a function of really not looking at either the right test or not looking at, you know, Lyme and these tick-borne diseases in the right way. But I think it's important that people understand that, you know, this really is a clinical diagnosis and your symptoms are the driving factor that determine, you know, whether you might have this illness.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that with everybody, because, you know, doing the Western blot test here and there with patients over the years, and, you know, they show up with two or three bands, but they have some of these symptoms that you're talking about, and it does, if it doesn't match the criteria, then it's really confusing for the patient. Like, oh, well, it says I don't have it, you know.
So, right. And, you know, and it gets even more confusing than that because some of the antibodies that we test for are very specific to Lyme disease and some of them are very non-specific. And again, I'm just amazed in 40 years of research that we've never revamped that criteria. At this point, why do we test for antibodies that aren't specific? Why don't we just hone in on the ones that are specific? I think that would, you know, certainly narrow down those false positives that are out there as rare as they are. And for whatever political reason, that just hasn't happened. So, you know, I think for those of us that treat a lot of Lyme patients, you know, we read between the lines. And when we see a one antibody, we call it a band. When you see one band that's very specific to Lyme, which means as far as we know, there's no other microbe that triggers that antibody. You know, in my mind, it's kind of like being a little pregnant. I mean, you are or you aren't. So if you've got one band, what difference does it make if it's 2, 3, 4, or 5? And the CDC criteria is such that you need to have 2 out of 3 IgM bands or 5 out of 10 IgG bands to call your test positive. Well, sometimes people have 4 out of 5 instead of 5, or they've got 1 band instead of 2 on the IgM. So they've got some evidence. It just doesn't meet that criteria. Does that really mean they don't have Lyme? And, you know, of course not. You know, again, you have to look at the clinical symptoms. You have to look at their risk of exposure. But again, when I see these Western blots come back that have these antibodies that are very specific to Lyme, and they have clinical symptoms, and we've ruled out everything else, you know, again, I was taught if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck. And, you know, you just put all the pieces together, and that's usually how we come to the conclusion that someone's, you know, got Lyme disease.
Yeah, that's a really good summary. And I hope that people can pay attention to this, because it's challenging when people don't have this kind of education to explain it to, you know, a lay person not in medicine, and they don't understand all the ins and outs. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to add, you know, I think there's a false sense of security sometimes. And I've heard this, you know, coming to California here in the last year after having been in Connecticut for almost 20 years, I've heard doctors here say, you know, well, you can have Lyme, you know, there's no Lyme in California. And I'm sure you get that in Washington State and a lot of these other states. And again, it's just an ignorant position. People who aren't reading and keeping up with the literature, because again, it's been reported in every state. So if anyone's ever had the experience of, you know, thinking they might have Lyme, they were told by their doctor, oh, it doesn't exist in this state. Well, that's just nonsense. It's not true. Again, it's been reported in all states. So my recommendation is get in the hands of someone who understands this better and can actually go through the process of making sure that you're tested appropriately.
Yeah, that's the best advice that I think anybody could hear. So yeah, thanks for saying that. And with Lyme disease, let's say a patient comes in and they have all these symptoms, do you still do a Western blot with them, or do you just go right into treatment and say, you know, you have Lyme, I'm a Lyme specialist, I see this all the time, let's just get down to treatment?
I think it's good to do the testing for a lot of reasons. A, of course, you know, just having documentation that what you're treating is actually what you think it is. That's very helpful. I think sometimes it's also just for as a patient, you know, you just want to know what's wrong with you. And to finally be able to say, you know, I've been, you know, having these symptoms for years, I've been brushed off by my other practitioners, and here's finally an answer, you know, that just for a lot of people's psyche is huge. Plus it also helps, you know, buy into, you know, when we're going forward in treatment, because treatment does tend to be a long-term thing. If you know that you're working towards this goal of, you know, helping get this under control, it just makes everything a lot easier for both parties. So there's definitely value in doing testing. And look, you know, we do work with other labs that offer better testing than most reference labs. You know, if you've done your testing through Quest and LabCorp, and if it came back positive, great, you got lucky. More often than not, those tests come back negative. We use a specialty lab, and then we find back that the test comes back positive. So there are other labs out there that do offer more sensitive testing, better testing. You're more likely to pick it up with those labs than you are through the regular reference labs. But again, you know, you're probably not going to get that kind of testing through your primary care doctor. You may have to seek out someone who's a bit more knowledgeable about the other tests that are available. But, you know, again, I think, you know, knowing what you're specifically dealing with. And we also know that, you know, a lot of these ticks carry more than just Lyme. So it's really important that we test for other types of co-infections that these ticks can carry. You know, when I was up in New England, up to 37% of ticks carry at least one other organism outside of Lyme. You know, that's a high percentage. So from a treatment standpoint, sometimes it's important to know if you're dealing with Lyme plus Bartonella, Lyme plus Mycoplasma, Lyme plus something else. You know, once in a blue moon, we'll get these patients where they've got, you know, 3 or 4 infections raging at the same time. And, you know, that's very useful to know, because now you've got something too you can monitor over time. In addition to how people feel with their improvement, you can also, you know, use these tests as a way to see how people are responding.
And what's your favorite or your go-to advanced or more advanced lab test to diagnose Lyme?
So there's a few labs that I use, and it kind of depends just on the patient for various reasons. Some of these participate with insurance, some of them are cash. But the labs I tend to use most, there's a lab called Global Lyme Diagnostics. I'm actually on their scientific advisory board. And what I like about this lab, they're out of North Carolina. The doctor that developed the test is actually a vaccinologist. He was actually tasked to come up with a vaccine for dogs. And I'm not sure he ever did that, but what he did discover is that there's a protein on the Borrelia organism that's unique to all Borrelia species. So unlike the other conventional tests that really only look at one strain, this is casting a much wider net now, looking at all the different strains. So whether someone got exposed in, you know, California, Vermont, Idaho, it won't make a difference. You know, you're still likely to pick it up with this test. So I think that's a great screening tool. And beyond that, I use a lab called Medical Diagnostic Labs in Hamilton, New Jersey. I like them because I think they offer a much more sensitive test. They will actually send you, the doctor, a copy of the Western blot so you can actually take a look at it yourself, where most other labs do their own interpretation. So I like being able, again, for someone who used to do this for a living, I like to be able to look at the strip myself. I also like MDL because they bill insurance. So for people who've already spent a lot of money out of pocket, it's nice that they finally have something that insurance will pay for. And that particular lab contracts pretty much with everybody out there. So they're a great lab. There's a lab called Igenex up in the Bay Area of California. They've been around a long time. They offer fantastic testing. My only complaint with them is just that it's cash pricing. They don't participate with insurance outside of Medicare. And as a naturopath, we're not dealing too much with Medicare. So it's it just ends up being a little bit cost prohibitive for a lot of people. Because if you do Lyme and the full battery of tests, it can run $1,500, $1,800. So it gets to be pretty expensive for folks. But the quality of their testing is great. And then there's a lab out of Germany called Armin Labs that I've used. And their testing is unique in that it's not testing antibodies. It's actually looking at cytokines. So if you've got somebody who might be immune deficient, or maybe their immune system doesn't work the way it should, you know, an antibody test may not be the best way to evaluate it. Whereas if you use a cytokine test, it's completely independent of antibody responses. And again, for someone who might have very early Lyme disease, or if you're really just trying to assess activity, I find that cytokine testing is a little bit better. So again, between all these different labs, it really kind of comes down to each person, what we think is in their better interest. But again, we're trying to find, you know, what the right test or tests are going to be to give us the best information.
Great. Yeah, that's really helpful. And maybe for our listeners that aren't in the medical community or scientists, could you explain the difference between cytokines and immunoglobulins?
Sure. So, you know, your immune system is comprised of a lot of different cells and a lot of different chemicals. They all play a different role. So antibodies or immunoglobulins, their job is basically, if you come in across something that's foreign, so maybe it's a bacteria or a virus, these immunoglobulins, your immune system says, hey, I see something over there that doesn't belong. It starts making antibodies that are specific to that virus or bacteria. Then the antibody basically latches onto it, and then it signals the rest of your immune system to come get rid of it. So basically, your antibodies are basically a mediator of helping the rest of your immune system get rid of these different foreign agents. Cytokines are a little bit different. Cytokines are actually chemicals, and they're secreted by various types of your immune cells. And so they're basically signaling chemicals that tell the rest of your immune system that, hey, that there's a problem. So the cytokines themselves can be pro-inflammatory, they can be anti-inflammatory, they have their own direct and indirect effects. But unlike other parts of your immune system that will either directly, you know, get rid of the foreign body or will signal directly, the cytokines are really just more the chemical that's a reaction in between those other processes. So, you know, they're just a little bit different. They're just measuring different parts of the immune system. But both of them, you know, can react when you've had some sort of foreign microbe. And again, we do this not just for Lyme, but if you've had, you know, Epstein-Barr or strep or anything else, you know, it's the same kind of process.
Excellent. Yeah, that's a good educational bit for people. So what's an example of a cytokine? We talked about examples of antibodies, immunoglobulins, IgG, IgM. What is an example of one or two of those cytokines that you would test for using this lab in Germany?
Well, the test methodology that Armin Labs uses is their own proprietary technology. Mm-hmm. They don't exactly tell you what specific cytokines they're measuring. Their test is called like an ELISpot, and ELISpot is probably measuring for a series of cytokines. It's not one specific chemical, but all of those are very specific for...
When you save on auto insurance for driving safe with USAA SafePilot, you'll feel like a big deal. Even in a traffic jam. Save up to 30% with USAA SafePilot. Restrictions apply.
I'm on a city street in Virginia, standing in an empty parking space, where just last night, Bob's car was stolen. Did you see Bob's car get stolen? Probably not. But do you know who's been stealing cars in Virginia? You could get a reward of up to $25,000. Submit a confidential tip at heatreward.com or call 1-800-947-HEAT. The HEAT program from the Virginia State Police. Reported. Rewarded.
The organism that you're testing for. So there's a cytokine test for Borrelia, which is Lyme. There's a cytokine test for Bartonella, which is a different bacteria. So there's cytokine testing for each of the individual organisms that you're testing. But it's actually, as far as I understand, it's a mix of different chemicals, and it's not one specific chemical.
Okay, I see. And with the co-infections, I think we should kind of try to explain to people what these co-infections are and maybe how, I know it's a big topic, but how they're different than Lyme disease and maybe the different symptom picture that people should be looking out for co-infections, and if there's anything related more to men's health or just generalized fatigue or joint pains, et cetera, that might be similar, but also different than Lyme disease.
Sure. Yeah, you know, there's a lot of overlap of all these tick-borne diseases. You know, all of them can make you tired. Most of them can cause joint pain or muscle weakness or things of that nature. I think some of the more common ones that we see in North America anyway, Bartonella is quite common. Bartonella is the bacteria that we associate with what's called cat scratch fever. So cats are natural reservoirs for Bartonella. And of course, if a cat scratches you, you can get this infection on your skin. The Bartonella that people get through a tick bite is actually quite different than what you get through cat scratch fever. But Bartonella has a couple of characteristic things. Probably the most characteristic one is that you can get these marks on your skin that look like stretch marks. But what's different about stretch marks is that real stretch marks, you know, if you've gained or lost a lot of weight, you'll see these streaks along your skin folds that are generally clear. And with Bartonella, these streaks are generally very dark purple to red, and they don't follow the lines of your skin folds. Often you'll see them even perpendicular. So, you know, when you've been overweight, you know, where your fat starts to roll on itself, there's a skin line. And, you know, when you've lost that weight, you'll see where that residual line is that's, you know, kind of clear to white. But with Bartonella, you'll see them turn dark purple, and they're kind of sporadic. And we usually see them on the torso. Sometimes you'll see them on the arms or the legs, but most often it's around the torso. So that's a very classic Bartonella sign. Bartonella is also very well associated with what we call neuropathy. This is numbness and tingling, particularly in the feet, or people will complain of like burning feet, which is a type of neuropathy. But with Bartonella, that's something that people see quite often. Another common thing we see with Lyme is called Babesia. Babesia is actually a blood parasite. It's a cousin of malaria. So you kind of get like malaria-light symptoms. And for people who don't know what malaria is, this is a mosquito-borne illness that you see in Southeast Asia and Africa, and really not here in North America. But you get these cyclical fevers. You get very sick, swollen glands. And with Babesia, we get sort of a milder version of that, where people will complain of cyclical fever. And it could be every 3 days. It could be every 3 weeks. There is a pattern to it, but it does vary from person to person. And with Babesia, we also get this thing called air hunger, where people just feel this need that they got to take a deep breath. And, you know, they don't have a history of asthma or shortness of breath, but they just feel like there's a pressure on their chest. They have a difficult time taking a deep breath. And, you know, that's another symptom that's pretty typical for Babesia. You know, the other co-infections out there, there's not a whole lot that's really unique to them. But, you know, there's anaplasma, there's Ehrlichia, there's mycoplasma. All of them can cause various, you know, overlap of symptoms, again, like fatigue and joint pain and headaches and swollen glands. Ehrlichia and anaplasma both have the capacity to invade your white blood cells. So often for people who have these illnesses, when you do a blood count, just a routine blood test, you'll find that your white count tends to run very low. Now, again, there's a lot of other reasons that that can happen, but that is one of the things that's a little bit more characteristic to those illnesses over Lyme disease, where most Lyme patients we see, their white count looks perfectly normal. So, you know, those are some of the more common ones. But again, you know, every time I go to a Lyme conference, it seems like we've got another long list of things that people can get through tick bites. There's a lot of viruses. You know, what's emerged in the last couple of years out of New England is what's called Powassan virus. And Powassan virus, to me, I think is very scary. It's it moves very fast in the body. People get very acutely ill with very high fever. It's been attributed now to several deaths. And by the time people figure out what's going on, it's too late. So, you know, there are labs that do offer that test. But, you know, again, fortunately, we haven't seen too many cases outside of New England. But it is one of the newer emerging viruses that we see associated with tick bites.
Yeah, that is frightening. And that's coming from New England only.
Yeah, so far I've heard of cases in New York, Pennsylvania. I think there was a case up in either Vermont or New Hampshire, but I have not heard if there have been other cases out here on the West Coast or in the central part of the U.S.
Okay, so we're safe for now. yeah, so I want to back up a little bit and just maybe offer some people some hope of protecting themselves in the wilderness if people are, you know, going out on hunting trips. I'm here in Montana and there's a lot of hunting here, and back home in Vermont, there's hunting season every year, going out hunting deer, elk, and whatever. Or hiking in the Cascade Mountains and whatnot. What sprays or clothing combinations you recommend to patients to protect themselves from getting reinfected if they've been infected, or to prevent other family members from getting infected by tick bites?
Yeah, so for people who really spend a lot of time outdoors, so whether you're a hunter, camper, or just, you know, avid hiker, particularly, again, if you're in an area where, you know, ticks are known to be a problem, you know, your best protection is barriers. So I tell people, you know, even if it's in the dead of summer where it's hot or humid outside, wear long clothing. You know, that long clothing does provide a barrier between you and the tick. So that means long pants, long sleeve shirts. Tuck your pants into your socks so that the ticks can't slide through. You know, these ticks are clever in a way that they manage to get through, you know, these gaps in clothing and can, you know, start, you know, causing a problem. So long clothing, you know, wear a hat if you're going to be, you know, hiking or moving through an area where there's a lot of overhead brush to keep it from getting in your hair. And in terms of other sprays, you know, the conventional approach is DEET. DEET, and of course, we don't recommend that for a lot of reasons. It's horribly toxic, can cause other kinds of problems. So there's actually some research using essential oils, and there's several companies that make nice organic essential oil sprays that's usually a combination of like lemon balm oil, eucalyptus oil, thyme oil, clove oil. Yeah, all these oils have been shown to be, you know, helpful repelling ticks. And so I tell people, if you know you're going to be outdoors all day, you know, bring one of these little spray bottles with you every, you know, couple of hours, reapply. The nice thing about it, of course, it's safe. You know, you don't want to spray it into mucous membranes. It can be very irritating, but you can spray it over the top of your clothes. If people really feel adamant that they need to wear shorts and short sleeve shirts, you can actually apply it directly to the skin if need be. It's safe to use in children. So really for the whole family, it's an easy way to help protect yourself. And again, if you've been out, you know, doing those activities, when you get home, strip off the clothes, help each other do tick checks, effectively, you know, parents for, you know, their kids, look at all those, you know, dark crevices of the body. Kids don't necessarily like it, but it really is the safest way to ensure that you haven't, you know, picked up a tick. And again, just keep in mind, these ticks are really very tiny. So what I've advocated for people who, you know, live in Montana or live in these areas where there's a lot of outdoor activity, you can buy these tweezers that have a little magnifying glass attached to them. And it just helps, you know, see it a little bit better. And if you see something on the skin that's suspicious, grab those tweezers with the magnifying glass, take a look. Is it really just dirt, or, you know, do you see little legs and it moving on your skin, or is it already embedded? And if it is, you know, at least you've got the right tool there to help, you know, extract it.
Yeah, that's perfect advice. And that, I mean, that's always a concern for me, because I did actually get Lyme disease somewhere in New England growing up. I was all around New Hampshire, Vermont, Massachusetts, et cetera. And I don't think people were really talking about Lyme disease the way they are now in the 90s and 80s. At least right. I don't remember it. I mean, there was a concern for ticks, but it seemed like it was, you know, maybe 1,000 people in all of New England total, including Boston, that maybe people knew about had Lyme disease. So being able to prevent reinfection, knowing now that there's these multiple strains that people can get in Montana or California or Seattle area, is really hopeful for a lot of people. Cause I've heard people say, oh, well, don't go up to North Bend, Washington and go hike, you know, Mount Si, because you can get Lyme disease, and they're like staying in their home all freaked out to go anywhere. So hopefully people cannot be scared of the woods, but still get outside and protect themselves accordingly.
Yeah. And I think, you know, particularly for people who are hikers, you know, most, you know, national parks and other places, you know, they have, you know, cut out paths. And, you know, again, these ticks are basically parasites. You know, they hang out on the foliage. So if you're walking just down a dirt path, you're going to be far less likely to pick up a tick. But if you, you know, decide you want to go off path and you want to just navigate through the shrubs and the jungle or wherever you're at, you know, that's where you're going to be more likely to, you know, come in contact with that tick. You know, ticks don't really jump. So, you know, they need to have close contact to you to be able to move on to you. So if you just stay on the path, you're going to be less likely to be exposed. Don't go off path if you really don't have to. And for the people out there who are, you know, campers and really who like to do that, I mean, you know, just fine. Just, you know, just be aware that, you know, your risk is a little bit higher. Just make sure you do your diligence to protect yourself. And, you know, yeah, I don't think I would be afraid of, you know, being out there in the world, but you do need to have that mindfulness that there is a risk when you go to these areas, and just take the appropriate precautions to protect yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I mean, that should take away some of the fear factor, hopefully, for people. With Lyme disease, maybe for the people that don't know, I'd like to help them understand, you know, what a spirochete is versus just a rather regular bacterium, or you said it, you know, like parasites and things like that. Maybe help them understand, okay, what does this look like underneath the microscope, and what are we talking about here? Does it go into the blood? Does it go into the synovial fluid, the nervous system? Where does it like to hide out, and kind of what is a spirochete?
Yeah, spirochetes are, well, they're types of bacteria, but they're very unique. You know, most bacteria we have in our body are either called, you know, cocci, which are these little round balls, or they're rods, and they look like, you know, little oblong.
I'm on a city street in Virginia, standing in an empty parking space where just last night, Bob's car was stolen. Did you see Bob's car get stolen? Probably not. But do you know who's been stealing cars in Virginia? You could get a reward of up to $25,000. Submit a confidential tip at heatreward.com or call 1-800-947-HEAT. The HEAT program from the Virginia State Police. Reported. Rewarded.
I'm here in my living room, peering through my mini blinds at a man who's sawing off something under my neighbor's car. Yep, this guy is stealing catalytic converters. And if you report thieves like him, you could get a reward up to $25,000. Just submit a confidential tip at heatreward.com or call 1-800-947-HEAT. That's H-E-A-T. The Virginia State Police HEAT Program. Reported. Rewarded.
Shaped bacteria when you look under a microscope. And the spirochetes are different, that they're actually these sort of elongated corkscrew shaped organisms. So you can imagine if you took a long piece of string, and I guess the closest I can sort of equate it, it's kind of like a slinky. You know, the Slinky has that ability. You can pull it apart. You can stretch it out, and it's got that long coil, and then you can push it back together and make it very small. And so these spirochetes have sort of that accordion-like effect where they can elongate in their full adult form, but they also have the capacity to go dormant, and they literally ball themselves up. And so under a microscope, you'll see this little ball. But if you look really closely, like with an electron microscope, you can actually see that it is just this long organism that's just sort of wrapped itself up, and it's like you crunched up a piece of paper. So we think when it goes into this dormant phase, we call it the cyst or the round body phase, that it's dormant. It's not really doing anything. It's just hanging out. You know, part of the problem is that the immune system seems to not recognize Lyme when it goes into this form. It only recognizes it when it goes into that sort of, you know, elongated corkscrew form. So we think this is part of the way that Lyme is sort of, you know, surviving in our body, is that, you know, as soon as our immune system starts to gear it up, it balls itself up in this little ball. It goes and hides in different parts of the body. The immune system ignores it. And then at some point it starts to uncoil again, start creating problems. And, you know, we're back to having, you know, symptoms again. So, you know, Lyme is really truly a shapeshifter, unlike other bacteria that really don't seem to have that flexibility. You know, we know Lyme can take on at least three different forms. So it takes on its adult elongated form. It's got this cyst or round body form. And then they've got what they call a filamentous form, where basically it stretches itself out to this really long like rod. And so there's probably a reason behind its ability to do this shape-shifting. Again, our best assessment at this point is that it is a defense mechanism to protect itself from getting killed off. But, you know, unfortunately, the amount of dollars that get dumped into Lyme research is really relatively small relative to, you know, other illnesses out there that are far less common. You know, we just don't have a lot of resources to dig deeper into this.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate, especially with 400,000 plus people getting infected every year and probably growing every year after that.
Yeah. And, you know, this corkscrew shape also seems to allow it to penetrate into other tissues and cells better than other bacteria as well. So, you know, adding sort of insult to injury, you know, once you get exposed to this in your bloodstream, you know, literally like you took a corkscrew and you're trying to open a bottle of wine, you know, you start burrowing that corkscrew into the cork, it starts burrowing deeper and deeper. And, you know, we think that Lyme can do that to our tissues as well, because we've got studies where they've done post-mortem exams and they find Lyme in people's brains. They find it in other tissues. So, you know, whether it's the Lyme that invades the tissue itself that's the problem, or it's the immune reaction that creates inflammation, you know, we're not really sure. But again, there are very few organisms that we know of that have that capacity to get into tissues, which is why we see so many different symptoms, really, because it can get into your heart, it can get into your brain, it can get into your nervous system, it can get into your skin, it can get into other tissues. And I think depending on how, you know, it penetrates each individual, that just sort of determines what kind of symptoms that they'll manifest.
So in that case, if somebody's having brain fog or difficulties, you know, in the beginning, we were talking about difficulties remembering numbers or people's names, right, maybe, or where they put their keys. Could it actually already be in their nervous system and or part of their brain, potentially?
Yeah. Is it, yeah, when we, honestly, we don't really know. You know, when we do spinal taps on people that have Lyme, the yield is really, really low. It's actually very hard to measure even out of spinal fluid. So again, we're not sure if it's the organism that's penetrated directly or if it's the inflammatory response to the organism. You know, when I wrote the book, I came across several studies that show that Lyme targets very specific proteins, particularly in the nervous system. So really what's happening is it's triggering an autoimmune reaction. So it's not the organism that's penetrating the brain and eating your brain. You know, your immune system in response to the organism is now making antibodies and other immune cells that start attacking your nervous system. And that's what causes the symptoms. So this capacity to trigger autoimmunity, I think, is really the bigger problem with chronic Lyme disease than, you know, we've really, really thought of. So, you know, my approach has always been to treat Lyme more as an autoimmune disease than just treating it as a straight infection, because I think that autoimmune process is probably the bigger chunk of why people feel the way they feel.
Yeah, that's fascinating to me because I think you're the first person that I've ever heard say that. And I was reading that in your book when you released your book, and it makes, makes much more sense to me, especially with the numbers of autoimmune disease increasing as well.
And I'm thinking about, your listeners in particular, for men out there who've been dealing with various neurological issues, and I see this in my own practice. I mean, it can be anywhere from memory loss, brain fog, it can be sleep disturbances, it can be erectile dysfunction, it can be urinary problems, it can be bowel problems. You know, when you start to get that central nervous system involvement, anything that's downstream from that can potentially get affected. So, when I hear about men that are having, urinary problems, ED, those kind of things, particularly if it's in conjunction with the, these other type of symptoms like, arthritis and, fevers or so forth, again, that's a big red flag for me to investigate that.
Yeah. Thanks for saying that. Because a lot of guys are going to want to go for, testosterone and other versions of Viagra, Tadalafil, et cetera.
And right. I've seen that. Yeah, in my own practice, the men, and sometimes, we'll test them. They've got low testosterone. They've got all these symptoms. But the way you'll know is, when testosterone is generally the problem, you give them the testosterone and they feel remarkably better. Mm-hmm. You've got, your men where they've been on testosterone replacement and they're not feeling better. And you measure their blood levels and their blood levels are coming up, but they still feel tired. They still feel weak. Again, for me, that would be a concern that, testosterone is really not the bulk of the problem. And we know, again, from the research that, Lyme does have this disposition to disrupt your endocrine system. Thyroid is probably the most affected, but I've seen women that start having reproductive hormone issues. Some men that, start having other, issues with, testosterone, DHEA. So as Lyme affects, the brain and that part of the brain that's the upstream, sensor for, all the downstream stuff like testosterone and estrogen and progesterone and so forth, if that part of the brain gets affected, you're going to see those endocrine effects. So, that's really the tie-in of how Lyme and these other infections potentially can affect, your hormone system. So I think, as naturopathic doctors, we're always like, okay, your hormone levels are low, why? And I'm not sure how you've seen in your practice, but I'm getting all these young men in my practice, late teenagers, early 20s, they have a testosterone of 200. And is it because, there's other things going on? Have they been exposed to other endocrine disruptors? But again, when I start hearing about these other symptoms, it's part of our protocol now that we just sort of routinely screen people for Lyme and co-infections just to make sure that's not part of the problem, because clearly it takes you down a completely different treatment path. And sometimes you can save a lot of time and money of, using just hormones if there's some other kind of neurological thing that needs to be addressed.
Yeah, thanks so much for saying that, because I actually do a whole talk on testosterone, low testosterone in men. And there's a whole section where I talk about stealth infections, mono, reactivated mono, Lyme, right, et cetera. And oftentimes it's, the mind-blowing part for the layperson where they're just kind of like, okay, this is, wow. Either it's crazy or it's the light bulbs are going off and they're saying, okay, this makes sense. So, right, it's like, it's a coin toss to see how that's going to go. But most doctors out there aren't saying, okay, exactly what you said. Let's look at the stealth infections to save you time and money. Let's get the right diagnosis for the root cause diagnosis. Just because it's low thyroid and low testosterone, low adrenal function doesn't mean we need maybe short term to replace that, but that's not the end all be all. So with that said, are you able to see young men bring back their testosterone after, 6 to 12 months or 18 months of treatment for chronic Lyme?
Yeah, I mean, if that really is part of their root cause, we address these underlying infections. And I know we're talking about, Lyme specifically, but, we could broaden that umbrella a little bit and really say it applies to any underlying infection. You mentioned Epstein-Barr, I've seen it with mycoplasma. I've seen it with candida. I've seen it with these other things because, you know, most of these microbes do have this capacity to trigger this autoimmune problem and start causing endocrine issues. So it's not just Lyme, but yeah, I mean, you start dealing with these root infections and all of a sudden, you know, metabolism speeds up, their hormone levels start to balance. And again, whether it's adrenal, thyroid, or, you know, the reproductive hormones like testosterone, you know, we'll see that change. And it usually happens, you know, fairly quickly once you start dealing with the infection. I mean, I've seen, you know, even in the course of, you know, 4 to 6 weeks, you know, you'll start seeing testosterone levels double just from dealing with the infection. So again, it's clearly not the root of everybody, but for people, particularly if they've already been on some sort of replacement and they didn't get better, you know, that might be worth something to at least rule out as a possibility.
Yeah, I noticed that would happen a lot when in about 2013, I was working at a low-dose testosterone clinic, and there were a subgroup cohort of men that's exactly what happened. And about 3 months in, they said they felt exactly the same, and they had a little bit of improvement at about 6 weeks. And then at the three-month mark, they would say, you know, I don't feel at any improvement level. So unfortunately, in that clinic model, we weren't given the freedom to just say, okay, let's find a root cause diagnosis. But that was what I was always thinking in the back of my head. What is really going on here? As far as Lyme disease, maybe get a little bit more broad. I know there's a huge debate in the conventional world between, you know, acute Lyme versus chronic Lyme. And obviously we're talking more about chronic Lyme disease, but for the uneducated or the uninitiated into the Lyme disease world or stealth infection world for that matter, what's your kind of like go-to educational bit of how to explain, okay, this is an acute infection and then it becomes a chronic infection?
Well, you know, my own experience with someone who had acute Lyme disease and having every sign and symptom, you know, there was no mistaking that I was acute.
I'm on a city street in Virginia, standing in an empty parking space where just last night, Bob's car was stolen. Did you see Bob's car get stolen? Probably not. But do you know who's been stealing cars in Virginia? You could get a reward of up to $25,000. Submit a confidential tip at heatreward.com or call 1-800-947-HEAT. The HEAT program from the Virginia State Police. Reported. Rewarded.
I'm here in my living room peering through my mini blinds at a man who's sawing off something under my neighbor's car. Yep, this guy is stealing catalytic converters. And if you report thieves like him, you could get a reward up to $25,000. Just submit a confidential tip at heatreward.com or call 1-800-947-HEAT. That's H-E-A-T. The Virginia State Police HEAT Program. Reported. Rewarded.
Leal. Again, I think, unfortunately, that is not the bulk of people who get exposed to Lyme. Those people are usually easy to pick out of a crowd. And again, at least if you're a practitioner in an area where Lyme's endemic, most practitioners are pretty savvy to that and pick up on it pretty easily. You know, I think where we're having all these people fall through the cracks, the people who just didn't get all the classic Lyme symptoms. And again, I think this is where we have a departure from the CDC and other public health departments that seem to think that most people who get Lyme disease get classic Lyme disease, they get all the classic symptoms and the bullseye rash, and that everyone who's outside of that box doesn't really have Lyme disease. And again, we just have, you know, a mound of research now showing that that's not true. And there's been some really interesting research out of Johns Hopkins. Dr. Zhang has been showing that there is a percentage of these Lyme bacteria that are just completely resistant to antibiotics, and they're called persister cells. And, you know, it could be 15%, 20%, but it's a fairly high percentage. So even if you get diagnosed on time and you're treated, you know, according to CDC guidelines, you know, 10 to 21 days of doxycycline, you know, there are still a percentage of these bacteria that may not be affected. And then over time, those have the potential to create sort of these long-term problems. You know, the CDC's coined this, you know, post-Lyme treatment disease syndrome, or post-Lyme disease treatment syndrome, which is a nebulous, we don't really know what's wrong with you, but it's not Lyme disease. And I think most of us who have actually dealt with chronic Lyme disagree with that definition. So, you know, we've got this split between the CDC and the Infectious Disease Society of America, and then doctors like myself and other ILADS doctors, that's the International Lyme and Associated Disease Society. You know, we're all in the camp that, hey, look, you know, there's a lot of people who don't fit that tight definition from the CDC of having Lyme disease. They've got biomarkers of Lyme, they've got clinical symptoms of Lyme, and they've been dealing with this for months to years. So, you know, if there's something else going on that we haven't figured out, I suppose it's possible. But, you know, people will tell you consistently, this all started after I was diagnosed with Lyme disease and started having those symptoms. So there's a tie-in. And again, I think, when you look at the medical literature and you see this association of Lyme really triggering autoimmunity, you know, that just makes so much sense to me that, you know, even if the organism's been eradicated, if we still have this switch that's been turned on in the immune system towards autoimmunity, and that's what's affecting your joints and your muscles and your nerves and so forth, you know, maybe really that's, you know, what we're trying to contend with. So, you know, because there's been such a lack of research in this area, you know, most of this has been done, you know, in such small numbers of people, that's really just looking to say that, yes, it exists, but not really so much on, okay, now what do you do about it? And from a conventional medical standpoint, there's really no major drug that addresses it. There's no commonly agreed on therapy that everybody who's in this boat can do that actually helps. So it just leaves these people out searching on their own, trying to find different practitioners that offer various therapies. And like, you know, any other therapy out there in the world, sometimes it works really great and sometimes it doesn't work at all. And what's been a miracle for one person was a disaster for the next. So we as Lyme practitioners really are kind of in that position that, you know, we're trying to find what the right combination is from you. And based on all of our experience, there are certain things that we can feel quite confident are going to work better for you than others. But, you know, there's no guarantee. And at the end of the day, you know, we're all trying to find what's suited for you, with the understanding that we may have to go through, you know, a series of different treatments to really find the one that best fits you.
That's a brilliant explanation of, you know, chronic Lyme. And personally, I find the CDC's explanation pretty much offensive. I mean, it's basically like saying, well, that doesn't exist and it's all in your head and good luck, you know?
Yeah, you know, this has been their mantra for many years, and it's been a point of contention. And in fact, the IDSA is actually developing new guidelines that are supposed to come out this fall. And it's even worse than what they had before. I mean, it used to be, you know, I think 10 to 21 days of antibiotics was like the standard therapy. Now they want to shorten it. And I think they're recommending up no more than 14 days. You know, they're treating this like a sinus infection. And, you know, to put it in perspective, you know, most bacteria in your body replicate every 10 to 20 minutes. Tuberculosis, which fortunately we don't see very much anymore, is an extremely slow growing organism. And if you get diagnosed with tuberculosis, the standard of care is 3 antibiotics, which are all very heavy duty antibiotics, for anywhere from 9 months to a year. So we use these long-term heavy duty antibiotics because tuberculosis is a very slow growing organism. Now, to put that in perspective, again, if most bacteria replicate every 10 to 20 minutes, TB replicates every 15 to 20 hours. So relatively, you can say, yeah, that's pretty slow. Now, consider that the research on Lyme suggests it replicates every 1 to 16 days. So why on earth are we okay with giving triple antibiotic therapy for TB for an organism that replicates every 15 to 20 hours, but Borrelia that replicates every 1 to 16 days, we want to treat in 10 days? You know, it just doesn't make any freaking sense whatsoever. So I've never had an opportunity to talk to the upper ups, you know, on the government on why they came to that conclusion, because that's not what the research says at all. And I mean, I think in our world as naturopathic doctors, you know, we're not keen on giving people long-term antibiotics anyway for a lot of other reasons. And that certainly wouldn't be my approach, but it would make more sense than the current recommendation. But, you know, the new guidelines that are going to be coming out, and I'm sure it will be ratified before the end of the year, is actually going to be more restrictive than what we currently have. And what that means for our patients is that, you know, these are the guidelines that most insurance companies follow. So for people who are trying to get, you know, even conventional treatment through that avenue, it makes it more restrictive, less treatment. And I think it's going to continue to lead to more and more people having chronic Lyme problems because they're just not really getting appropriate treatment.
So as far as antibiotics, I've been to conferences and listened to Chinese herbalists and specialists and, you know, Dr. Klinghardt and all these different opinions about antibiotics. And I've seen patients that want a second opinion about their doctor using antibiotics for their Lyme. And it doesn't seem to, from what I've seen most of the time, it doesn't seem to really work out that well, in summary, most of the time. What's your opinion for using antibiotics for, you know, 3 months with somebody and cycling different antibiotics through a 3 month treatment plan for Lyme disease?
Well, my experience and the research are pretty much in line that, you know, antibiotics, if you have acute Lyme disease, is actually very well indicated. Again, it's not the bulk of people I see, but if I had someone who I felt was really acutely exposed, I would have no problem using an antibiotic. Unfortunately, most of the people I see have been exposed a long time ago. And, you know, when you get outside of that early window, and whether it's, you know, 3 months, 6 months, you know, we don't really have that well defined. But the research is pretty clear too that, you know, one of two things typically happens. You know, either you feel better when you're on antibiotics and as soon as you come off, you start to feel worse again, or you just feel worse from the get-go and you don't really get any clinical improvement. You know, you will hear about people who've had chronic Lyme, went on antibiotics and report that they felt well. So great, that does happen. But again, I don't think that's the bulk of the people, because again, I'm seeing a lot of people that have gone down that road. They've been on antibiotics for months. I mean, I once saw a patient when I was in Connecticut. She had been working with a very well-known Lyme doctor in the area, and she had been on antibiotics continuously for 12 years. And she had been hospitalized 3 times because of the antibiotics.
Wow.
So in my mind, I'm like, boy, at what point do you draw a line in the sand and go, this is really not the best treatment? You know, maybe we need to think of another thing. But again, I think there's a lot of doctors, you know, even the good Lyme doctors who I've got a lot of respect for. I mean, they're taking on really hard work. But, you know, when do you decide that this treatment isn't the best approach? And, you know, we know that the antibiotics disrupt your normal gut flora in addition to all your other microbiome. We know that most antibiotics actually damage your mitochondria. So Lyme itself can damage your mitochondria. The drugs can damage your mitochondria. And for people who don't know what the mitochondria are, you know, these are the parts of your cell that literally make energy. You know, your energy, your metabolism are centered around having mitochondria that function well. So when you damage that part of this, your cells, you know, if your primary issue is fatigue or weakness, I mean, good luck. You're going to have a hard time getting that back when you're on this treatment, because the treatment itself is actually making that worse. So, you know, I think, you know, when people get into that persistent chronic Lyme stage, you know, they really need to start looking at other alternatives. And, you know, that's really what I outlined in my book, is, you know, kind of walking people through those steps of, you know, here's, you know, things you can do to heal your gut. Here's a diet you can follow. Here's some herbs that are going to help support you in a healthy way versus just wiping out your gut flora, yet they're still very effective at dealing with Lyme. And then we go through other things in terms of just, you know, self-care, getting good sleep, moving your body. You know, it's kind of naturopathic medicine 101, but for people who are new to this, you know, there is a way that you can control how you react to these things. And a lot of it really does fall within, you know, each person's hands. You know, your doctor doesn't have to do everything for you. There are things that you can do at home for free that are really going to make a big dent in, you know, getting over the hump.
Yeah, well said. Yeah. And as far as exercise, are you seeing any patients that maybe are starting to feel better, have chronic Lyme disease, and then they're getting into some of these extreme fitness, I guess, almost like cultures like CrossFit or long distance running, et cetera, and then crashing again from overdoing it with the exercise and then the kind of the Lyme flaring up? Are you seeing anything like that? Or are you seeing exercise in general just make people better and stronger in their immune function?
Well, you know, in the Lyme community, I think there's that tendency, you know, if you've gotten to a point where you can now move your body, because a lot of people I work with, they're so exhausted, the thought of doing any kind of physical activity is challenging. So, you know, we talk about starting with very gentle exercises, even like stretching. I mean, I know when I was in the throes of Lyme, I could barely get off the couch. So I would literally plop in front of the couch and just stretch. You know, that didn't require a lot of energy, yet I think there's still some benefit. And then I started doing laps around the house and then, you know, laps around the neighborhood. And, you know, eventually I picked up martial arts and I think 8 years later got a black belt in karate. So it took a long, long time to feel like I got my mojo back. But I think, you know, with exercise, there's a lot of health benefits, you know, from what it does for you physically, certainly what it does for people mentally. I think, you know, getting any kind of movement in, but with the understanding that if you overextend yourself, you know, there is that risk that you're going to crash and be out for the next 3 or 4 days. You know, I've got one Lyme patient now who's, you know, pretty high functioning, and she runs, you know, 3 to 5 miles a day. And her husband was very concerned, says, oh my gosh, isn't that damaging her? I'm like, well, no, because she doesn't get wiped out for us. So she's moving her blood. She's getting that oxygenation, bringing all the healthy nutrients to the tissue, moving the lymph. So I think, you know, exercise just has to be tailored to the person. But as much as people feel like they can tolerate, I'm an advocate for doing it because I just see so many positive health benefits.
Yeah. Yeah. Exercise is good medicine. And I mean, I'm always mentioning exercise to patients, and a lot of them are workaholics and they don't have time for it, but sooner or later we got to make time for our health. With Lyme disease, have you found any research about it decreasing hormone function, whether or not it's testosterone or not, it's fine, but, you know, thyroid, adrenal function, is there any research to kind of back up this, what we're seeing clinically?
Yeah, surprisingly, no. Not that I've come across. It's really been clinical observation. And, you know, we talk with other practitioners, and this has been the observation of other people. There, I think, is one study that I can recall specifically looking at Lyme and thyroid. But in terms of Lyme and testosterone, to the best of my knowledge, I haven't seen that literature.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, if it's damaging mitochondria, then it's going to affect hormones in the glands. I would, you know, the mechanism seems pretty clear.
Yeah, there's just, you know, so many things we really would love to look at with Lyme. And again, the funding just isn't there.
That's too bad. Somebody shared kind of an analogy to me between, even though I know HIV is obviously a virus, but, you know, HIV went through its research and kind of heroic medicine research to find a, you know, a cocktail. And obviously that's changed over the years. As far as Lyme disease, I've heard stats that it's more common than breast cancer and a lot of other things where we have all these, you know, run, you know, a 5K for breast cancer every 6 months in every city around the country. And, you know, every other person knows somebody or five people who have had breast cancer. And, you know, as far as Lyme disease, it seems like, you know, some people are in the know, and then other people are kind of look at you like you're a conspiracy theorist, and it's like, well, chronic Lyme disease doesn't exist. So I'm just curious, you know, what is it? I mean, from your point of view, being on the front lines and you're a specialist in this, what is it going to take for the country to get so sick that we finally do something? Are more people going to have to die from this virus in New England that's a co-infection, or, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, you know, I equate the Lyme epidemic much like what happened with HIV in the early 80s. I see it very similar. You know, we really ignored it. We denied it. You know, we said it was only, you know, gay people who had it. You know, we really tried to marginalize people who had the condition. And I see the same exact thing happening with Lyme. I think part of it is the recognition that if this is as big as we think it is, which we know it is, that means a huge, huge cost to our healthcare system. Now you got to take care of these people. If you really start acknowledging that these folks are ill, they've got these legitimate, you know, issues, someone's got to pay for it, got to pay for the care. And that's going to be, you know, billions and billions of dollars or more. So I think that's part of the political thing behind it, is just that recognition that it's going to be a big expense to the healthcare system. Beyond that, again, I don't really understand why we have been so lackadaisical in really bringing Lyme to the forefront. You know, again, the literature's out there. We've got tons of research. you know, showing, you know, what a problem it is. The World Health Organization has even published a paper on this. So, you know, we've got all this data showing it's a problem, showing how many people are affected, and patients just coming forward for, you know, being their own advocate saying, look, you know, I am not feeling well. You know, I've been tested, I've got Lyme, and getting people to help them. I mean, I get calls from people all over the country and even now the world that are living in areas where they're told there is no Lyme, you don't have it, you know, go see a psychiatrist. And again, it's just an ignorant statement. And I think a lot of these people either aren't reading or they're cherry picking for whatever reason, what they do want to read. But it's certainly not based on science. And I never understood as a practitioner why you ignore patients. You know, we've got plenty of research on, you know, people who are malingerers. These are people who make up their health conditions. And I mean, from that research, it's like 0.001% of people who, you know, have these psychiatric illnesses where they actually make up their illness. You know, for the number of people who've been affected by Lyme, way, way, way more than that. So, you know, common sense tells you this is a problem. You know, the people who are, you know, actively seeking help and being denied, it just doesn't make any biological sense. And, you know, even if you are a doctor or a healthcare provider, if you really didn't believe it was Lyme, okay, then what is it? Then why aren't you doing the work to find out what it is? You know, again, I think doctors are getting lazier. They're just not, you know, doing their job and trying to get to the root cause of what it is. And, you know, I don't know that I have a great answer for it. I think, you know, we're all frustrated in the Lyme community with, you know, lack of government involvement. I mean, they started this tick-borne disease working group last year, and they have not really come out with anything helpful. They keep appointing people who deny chronic Lyme to this committee. So it's just been frustrating to, you know, get government officials, public health officials to acknowledge the scope of this problem and really starting getting serious and dumping serious, serious money. Because I'm sure if, you know, the government really got serious about it, you know, like other conditions we've had in the past. I mean, come on, remember we had this little outbreak of Ebola that hadn't even hit the United States. Mm-hmm. And yet we had a vaccine, you know, ready to go within a month.
Right.
So, you know, we know from history that when our government's really serious about, you know, investing into finding a solution for a health problem, you know, we have the resources to do it. But so far, they have not allocated those resources and we're kind of left in limbo.
Yeah, and it's surprising because, I mean, I know people like our past president, George W. Bush, has come out and said he has Lyme disease. A lot of famous actors and musicians. Yep. Have said they have Lyme disease and chronic fatigue syndrome, and it's taken them out of their careers. You know, they've had to stop touring. They're in bed in a hospital or at home. And personally, I mean, I've been a Lyme patient. It took forever to get a diagnosis personally, but I had chronic fatigue from 1998 until about 2013. And then I was diagnosed and then I went through the treatment and still having fatigue and other symptoms and somehow was able to get through, you know, naturopathic medical school with all that. But so many doctors just completely missed it, you know, MDs, NDs, et cetera. And it's definitely changed my view and paradigm on medicine to say, okay, root cause medicine is the medicine that everybody needs to be practicing. Because right. When it comes to cost, like you're saying, if we can get a root cause, you know, spending an extra $500 on lab testing could save you $100,000 over the next decade.
Right. So,
and time where you could be going back to work and working and making money to pay for your treatment as you get better. So with chronic Lyme, what is there, you know, can there be a natural cure? Have you ever seen someone go into complete remission where you're kind of like, hey, you know, come back in a year, you're good now? Or is it always a constant diligence of every 3 to 6 months checking in, having them on treatments that they're kind of a maintenance plan?
Yeah. I mean, I've had patients that, you know, live symptom free. It often takes a long time to get there. I mean, I tell people if they're new to our practice and they've been dealing with chronic Lyme, you know, it will probably take at least a year, if not longer, to get you to that point. I mean, I had one woman who came to see me from Arizona who had a lot of symptoms. It was pretty debilitated. And we started her on a protocol. And literally within like 3 to 4 weeks, she called me. She's like, I'm 100% better. I have no symptoms at all. She stayed on her treatment for another 4 to 6 weeks. We weaned her off and she's been fine since. So, you know, wow. Every now and then you get those folks who are just really great responders and they do really well. Unfortunately, that's not the bulk of people I work with. You know, it takes much longer to get to that point. But, you know, I think, you know, barring any legitimate nerve damage, tissue damage, I think, you know, the nature of our bodies is that, you know, we do have the capacity to heal. It's built into the DNA of every cell to repair itself. So it's really just about facilitating that process, but it is a slow process. And if I could find a better way to make it go faster, I would definitely do it. But, you know, because Lyme disrupts so many other organ systems, endocrine system, immune system, you know, again, that's why it's not just about going after the bug, but we really have to address all these other issues. So often now we're having to deal with these newfound allergies that people developed after they got Lyme. We've got to fix their thyroid, adrenal, or reproductive hormone issues. So we're still, you know, cleaning up the mess of what happened to the body after having that exposure. But, you know, once we get that situated again, you know, I do find there are, you know, a lot of people who can get to the point of living symptom-free. You know, the one question people ask a lot is, well, do you ever really get rid of Lyme? And the truth is, we don't know. I am of the opinion that I don't think we do. I think it's kind of like getting chicken pox when you're 5 years old and then shingles when you're 55. It's just the same virus that's been in your bodies. So if your immune system takes a hit, and I see the people that have been, you know, years of being symptom-free, you know, death of a family member, get divorced, some tragedy, you know, the stress piles up and then they start to relapse and get symptoms again. So I think, you know, Lyme does that have that capacity to be opportunistic, but that doesn't mean you can't get to a point where, you know, you're basically living symptom-free, you're able to do everything you want to do and, you know, live your healthy life. And at that point, you know, they don't necessarily have to take a bunch of pills to keep their immune system happy. You know, I think a lot of people can manage it through, you know, diet and lifestyle and exercise if they're really diligent and serious about it. So, you know, it's a long road for folks. And I always tell people up front that to be prepared for that. And you're going to have days where you feel great and days where you feel horrible, even though nothing changed. And it's really frustrating. It's just the normal roller coaster of Lyme and, you know, buckle in. But, you know, my expectation is that, you know, we do continue to see improvement and, you know, people just kind of have to hang in there for the long haul.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was hoping you would say something different, but that's what I thought. I was like crossing my fingers over here thinking, okay, maybe he has something. With as far as treatment, what are your thoughts on low-dose naltrexone and do you use it with patients?
Yeah, I use low-dose naltrexone with a lot of my patients. For my Lyme folks, you know, like any therapy, it's been kind of hit or miss, but my feeling is, you know, it's a very safe, inexpensive medication that's definitely worth a try. You know, they haven't done it. They've done research on low dose naltrexone, not specifically with Lyme disease, but because of its immune modulating effects, I think it's definitely worth a try. So I use it with most of my Lyme patients. We try it at some point just to see if it makes a difference.
I'm on a city street in Virginia, standing in an empty parking space where just last night, Bob's car was stolen. Did you see Bob's car get stolen? Probably not. But do you know who's been stealing cars in Virginia? You could get a reward of up to $25,000. Submit a confidential tip at heatreward.com or call 1-800-947-HEAT. The HEAT program from the Virginia State Police. Reported. Rewarded. I'm on a city street in Virginia, standing in an empty parking space where just last night, Bob's car was stolen. Did you see Bob's car get stolen? Probably not. But do you know who's been stealing cars in Virginia? You could get a reward of up to $25,000. Submit a confidential tip at heatreward.com or call 1-800-947-HEAT. The HEAT program from the Virginia State Police. Reported. Rewarded.
And my feeling is give it 3 months at least. See if you notice any improvement. If there's no improvement and we feel like if you're at a target dose, then, you know, we'll ditch it. But you know, there's some people who respond very well, and particularly for people where their problem is pain and arthritis and sleep issues, you know, sometimes naltrexone can make a big difference.
Excellent. Yeah. Yeah, I've taken it on and off, kind of cycle on and off of it, but it does seem sometimes like it works better than other times. And I don't know if that has to do with the infections cycle, like you were talking about earlier, where it's dormant and then active and dormant. But yeah, it does seem hit or miss. As far as long-term treatment, what are you seeing? And I know it obviously as naturopathic doctors, we're looking at treating the individual, working with individuals, but what are maybe one or three kind of top treatments, whether it's an IV therapy or herbs or whatnot, that is kind of like a core treatment that works for at least 60% or more of the Lyme patients that you've worked with?
Yeah. So, you know, I use a lot of the doctor that treated me when I first have Lyme. You know, he has his own protocol. His name's Dr. Zhang. He's in New York City and he's a medical doctor trained in China. And then he works as an acupuncturist in New York City. But he developed a line of Chinese herbal formulas. It's kind of a mix of traditional Chinese formulas with an understanding of modern biochemistry. So he tweaked a lot of these formulas to come up with his own line. And that's really my go-to for a lot of chronic Lyme patients, just because, again, I had such good success with it. I've seen a lot of people have done really well on his herbal protocols. So those are really kind of my go-to for people who can do it. You know, the biggest downside to his protocol is it's expensive. You know, out of all the herbs mm-hmm. out there, you know, it can run people $500+ a month, which is pretty expensive. But yeah. Again, for the people who can swing it, it does make a big clinical difference. So that's been very helpful. I actually found that other types of detox therapies for most of my Lyme patients actually work really well. I'm a big fan of colon hydrotherapy. You know, it's a big mental hurdle for people, but mm-hmm. they can get over it. I have had patients that have done every therapy under the sun, never got a lot of clinical benefit. And we get them, you know, doing colon hydrotherapy and all of a sudden, you know, their brain's much better. Their gut feels better. So, you know, for people to have access and are willing to try it, that has been one that's been great. And the third one that's really, I think, been a game changer for us is what's called LDI or low dose immunotherapy. Mm-hmm. So these are basically homeopathic nosodes. So these are dead bugs. So it's dead Lyme, dead Bartonella, dead Epstein-Barr, whatever it is, that's been diluted out millions and millions of time. And we mix it with an enzyme called beta-glucuronidase. And this enzyme is naturally found in your white blood cells, but it has sort of its own immune modulating effects. Plus, whatever you mix it with, it seems to help turn off that reaction. So if we believe that, you know, Lyme or one of these organisms has really triggered an autoimmune reaction, there's a way to flip that switch off. And this is a way to do it. So we'll give people, you know, these different dilutions of these mixes that we have. This was developed by Dr. Ty Vinson in Kona, Hawaii, and this came out about maybe 6 years ago now. And we've had some patients, again, who've tried a lot of therapies that have not been successful, and we use this, and then people's symptoms get dramatically better. And what I like about LDI is that when you give people doses, usually their reaction plus or minus happens within 24, 48 hours. So it's not like other therapies where you expect to wait months before you can really figure out if it's helping. You know, here the feedback's pretty quick, and we can often tell within a couple of days if we're on the right track or not. So that's really been a game changer in our practice. And again, for people who've been stuck with their therapies, sometimes this really helps move the needle.
Yeah, that's excellent. It sounds like it's really powerful combination, those three. What is the frequency that you usually recommend of colon hydrotherapy? And do you recommend that they get take a lot of probiotics after doing it? Or what do you see work? Is it once a month or once a week?
Yeah, what I typically have people do is start with two sessions a week for 3 weeks and then one session a week for 3 weeks. So give it 6 weeks, see how you feel. And then at that point, we make a decision about whether it's worth continuing. I think initially, you know, because for colon hydrotherapy, it's really not just about cleaning out the colon. We're really improving vagal tone. So we got this nerve called the vagus nerve that comes from your brain and it goes to all parts of your intestinal tract. So by stimulating that nerve, that's your biggest parasympathetic nerve in your body. You know, that's part of what helps you relax, calm down. So it helps drop your stress level, helps you sleep, and you get that feedback actually by doing that therapy. So by stretching out your colon with the water, you're stimulating that nerve that kind of activates it. So, you know, most people think when they go for colon hydrotherapy, they're just cleaning out their colon, which it does that, but that's not really the whole goal behind it. It really is for that vagal stimulation. So, you know, I think when people first started, you know, that's why I like the twice a week for a few weeks. You start mobilizing things, you're stimulating the nerve, you're really getting things moving. And then, you know, doing once a week after that for 3 weeks, just to kind of keep things moving along. And, you know, most people at that point will have a sense about whether it's helping them or not. And again, if we see like there's benefit, great, we'll stay on a weekly schedule for a while. Most colon hydrotherapists, at least that we work here in California, they all pretty much use probiotics during the session. And then they give you oral probiotics afterwards. So they're kind of helping replace what gets lost. But, you know, I've had some people say, oh my gosh, you know, you're losing all that bacteria when you go do colon hydrotherapy. I'm like, okay, that's true. But considering, you know, your bowel consists of trillions and trillions and trillions of microbes, even if you lost 10 or 20%, knowing that they replicate every 10 to 20 minutes, you know, you're going to repopulate that back pretty quickly. So we've got no evidence that there's any long-term complications or problems by doing colon hydrotherapy. You know, it's not wiping out your gut flora and doing all that stuff. But I think it's still a good idea to replenish with probiotics just to repopulate what might have gotten washed out anyway.
Okay. Yeah. That's, yeah. That seems really effective. I know I actually started seeing in 1999, seeing Dr. James Iadamo, Peter Diadamo's dad. And he was an old school naturopath and chiropractor from Brooklyn, New York, and, you know, had, I believe, worked up in Toronto and had a clinic in Toronto and New Hampshire. And I was going to the one in New Hampshire, and he did colon hydrotherapy. He did a bunch of clay detox and like the German foot baths and a lot of kind of old school, open up the detox pathways, naturopathic medicine, some herbal medicine diet, obviously the blood type diet that he discovered and used a lot. But yeah, it's, I mean, it's very effective. I think a lot of men even have a hard time thinking about, okay, I'm going to go home and do a coffee enema. So recommending colon hydrotherapy, they're kind of like looking at you like, okay, I don't know about this, but I do notice women are more open to it. And I have seen benefit as well with patients in Seattle. As far as autism, because you mentioned in your bio that you work with autistic patients, are you seeing a strong correlation between autism and a good percentage of autistic patients in Lyme disease?
In my practice, I find it's about 30% of the kids who've been diagnosed with autism also have been diagnosed with Lyme disease. Mm-hmm. So I've treated a lot of kids on the spectrum who also have Lyme. We'll find that a lot of their symptoms get better. I have yet to see a single child where their autism went away. So I don't believe that Lyme is necessarily a cause of autism. You know, we know that Lyme can be transmitted from mother to child. So it's really unknown, you know, can a pregnant mom transmit Lyme to a child that develops autism? Maybe. It's just that so many kids I see were developing normally up to a certain point, and then they stopped. I imagine if it was Lyme, they probably would have had developmental delays from the get-go. But, you know, again, this is an area where there's really no research at all. And we don't really know, but I've just, you know, my own patient population and having talked with other doctors that have similar practices, we've all kind of come to the conclusion that it's about 30% of these kids are also dealing with Lyme. And I think what it really speaks to is that most kids I see with autism, they already have this underlying immune dysfunction. So when they get exposed to anything, it tends to affect them more profoundly than other things. So whether it's strep throat, ear infections, bronchitis, I think Lyme is just another one that just affects them more deeply than other people. And perhaps they're just a little bit more susceptible.
Yeah, that's good to know. Because I know, I don't know a lot about autism, but I do know that it's a, you know, it seems like a very much multifactorial condition. And Lyme disease is, you know, as you said in the beginning today, very common. So I was curious about the connection there. And with autism, it is found more in boys, correct?
Yeah, boys outnumber girls 4-1.
Yeah, that's concerning for the future of, you know, men in the world. If, you know, 4-1, we're having more boys with autism. And are we approaching any, you know, known established treatment plan for autism for the population at this point, or is it similar to Lyme disease where it's kind of been left in the dark as far as research and things like that?
Yeah, you know, the autism research out there has really focused on genetics. You know, they've really been trying to find a genetic cause, yet there's no such thing as a genetic epidemic. So I think it's pretty clear that although there may be some genetic disposition, it's clearly not the cause. I think a lot of that money's really been wasted. But again, relative to the degree in which autism has become epidemic, we are not dedicating, you know, enough money or resources to really evaluate it further to find out why we have so many kids, you know, having these issues. You know, Dr. Stephanie Seneff, I'm not sure if you're familiar with her. She's a researcher at MIT. She's actually a computer scientist. She's not a physician, but she was very interested because she's a numbers person in this growing rate of autism. And in her research, she was looking at the rate of use of glyphosate or Roundup. And although they say, you know, correlation doesn't prove causation, when she did her computer modeling, the rate of autism and the rate of use of Roundup has something like a 98.6 correlation. Pretty interesting. So, you know, wow. Is that part of the contributing factor? And we know that Roundup has basically gotten into our entire food supply and that, you know, pregnant moms are getting exposed. So is it starting something, you know, in utero that sets the stage for something that happens later? Again, you know, we don't really know, but I think, you know, Dr. Seneff's research has been really interesting, and I know she's talking a lot about it. But again, I think, you know, autism is an environmental issue. It probably is a lot of different things between what happens, you know, before, you know, when there's conception, when there's fertilization, you know, what mom's exposed to during pregnancy, you know, there's so many factors that play a role from an environmental standpoint. I think it'd be hard to pinpoint which one thing or one, you know, few things, you know, really are contributing factors. But the fact that we have more kids with autism, ADD, you know, developmental issues, speech delay, autoimmune disease, diabetes, you know, we basically have a population of unhealthy children. You know, now more than half the children in this country are obese, is pretty telling about the nature of health of kids as a whole. And again, a lot of that really comes down to different environmental factors.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. I'm actually right now in Flathead County, Montana, and there's a lot of conventional agricultural farms here. And I was talking to an organic farmer in the valley last night, and he was mentioning that when they go to harvest the wheat right beforehand, they spray down the wheat.
Yeah.
And then harvest it. So it's the last thing they do, and they've already sprayed the whole season. So
right.
That's in our beer, that's in our bread, that's in our cereal, all this stuff.
Yeah, they found that Roundup is a really good drying agent. So yeah, they douse the wheat and Roundup before they harvest it. And understand, like, if you go to Italy or France, you eat the bread, the pasta, they don't do that there. So the quality of the food is very different. And but you know, apparently, again, I'm not a farmer, but I understand you get a higher yield by doing that. And the fact that they do it right before harvesting, of course, tells you that they're concentrating that chemical. And, you know, when you look at the research on glyphosate, you know, again, we know that it causes cancer, it causes other issues. So, you know, it's, you know, the World Health Organization came out and listed it as a, you know, potential carcinogen. And then the Italian researcher who came up with all this, you know, these studies, you know, he basically got blackballed and they cut his funding and, you know, really gave him a hard time. But, you know, we know it's a big problem. And they did a study here in California, I think it was a year or two ago, that found that all of the wine in California that's grown here is contaminated with glyphosate, even the organic wine. It's so pervasive in the water supply now that you can't even grow organic food without getting some levels of glyphosate. So again, it's become a problem.
Yeah, it's severe. And then in the last year, there's been the lawsuits, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars for people with lymphomas and things like that. And surprisingly, here in the valley, people are still crop dusting, and it's, you know, it's, people are just not aware, and they don't seem to care, and they have autoimmune disease, and I'm sure there's a lot of autism and other issues as such. With and the other thing I was going to say is that in my Facebook group, Livestrong. It's a men's only Facebook group. I'm often mentioning, you know, these things like roundups in our beer and wine. You yeah. might want to get that out of your diet and stop drinking that. What are you using to help motivate patients to not toxify themselves every day with, you know, conventional beer and California wine?
Well, you know, that's a great question. I think what motivates each person, you know, I think it's, I think the conversation that I've turned to now is, you know, are you really serious about your health? Are you really serious about being a father? Are you really serious about, you know, being here for your kids and your grandkids? Because if you are, you're going to take the right steps to ensure that you're actually going to be here. And I think there's a lot of people that have never really thought of it that way. You know, I think we tend to get very kind of egocentric about what happens to us that we kind of forget, you know, if you're a father, grandfather, or, you know, even if you're single and just, you know, what are your goals in life? Are you going to be able to achieve them if you are ill? You know, I think so many people take their health for granted. And again, for someone who's had his own personal health issues, I can look back on my life and say, boy, I really screwed up along the way. I wish I had known more earlier in life. I would have done things quite different. So, you know, knowledge is power, but at the end of the day, I think people need to get really, you know, quite clear about, you know, what is it that you really want out of life? And, you know, if you think that you're not going to be able to achieve that because your health gets in the way, then, you know, you got to take the appropriate steps to change that. You know, I think the beautiful thing about being human is that we have the capacity to make these decisions. We can change, and we can make changes for the positive that can often undo many of the bad habits we've acquired over the course of our lifetime. So sometimes people don't know how to do that. And that's where you and I step in and, you know, get to be teacher and teach them how to do that. But for the people who've really made that commitment, you know, I think it's a great process. And again, you know, we can undo a lot of those things and get people to a better state of health. But there are some people where they just aren't that serious about it. And if you're not at that place, then, you know, I don't know how much I can tell you to convince you otherwise. But, you know, I think, you know, in our clinic, and when we have that conversation and people kind of get that realization that, yeah, you know, I'm a young person. I want to be here longer, or you know what, I'm older, but I want to really enjoy what time I have left on this rock. And, you know, there are things you can do to intervene and have a much better life.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that. And unfortunately for a lot of people, it takes them getting pretty sick to make changes, or like you said, do you want to be around for your children, or do you want to be around to actually achieve your goals in this life, or you just want to party, you know?
Well, you know, yeah. I'll give you a great example. You know, I have a, you know, in my practice, it's mostly women and children, just because men, you know, they just don't ever go to the doctor unless something's broken, doesn't work, you know. They tend not to see doctors. But I had a husband come in. He's got three small children. And, you know, he's got a lot of health issues. He's overweight. He's got high blood pressure. He's borderline diabetic. And we also found out he's got Lyme disease. So, you know, we're having this conversation, and as we're talking, and I realized that, you know, he's thinking about how all these changes in his life is impacting his ability to do the things that he thinks are fun. You know, I think his impression is that all these changes are going to limit his diet and just life isn't going to be any fun. And then, you know, when we got a little deeper into some of the reasons why he didn't want to change, there were a few sort of psychological things that went back to his early childhood and some traumas. And we kind of talked through some of that. But, you know, he really wasn't thinking about how his health was impacting his family. And it was interesting because his wife is there, and actually one of his kids are there, and they're telling him directly how scared they are that, you know, daddy's not going to be here. And he had never heard those words before. It was really quite powerful for him to have that understanding that, oh my gosh, my family's worrying about me, that I'm not going to be here to help take care of them or just to participate in family activities. And for him, that was the kick in the pants to really start taking his health seriously. And thank goodness, you know, he really heeded that and took the right steps. And I'm, you know, happy reporting, you know, today he's actually doing really, really well. He's lost a lot of weight, you know, his blood pressure's down. He's controlled most of this really just through diet and lifestyle. You know, we've used very few supplements, but just a handful of select things. But again, I think for him, you know, he had to hear it from his own family that, you know, you're important. You need to be here. We want you to be here. And, you know, if you don't take these steps now, you're not going to be here. And again, I probably could have told him to it. I don't know if it would have had the same impact, but to have his wife and his daughter tell him was actually very, very impactful. So, you know, again, you know, I think people sometimes they don't realize the impact they're having on other people around them. And if they can have that greater understanding that they're important, they need to be here for lots of reasons, and that if they don't get serious about their health, they won't. So.
Yeah. Well said. That's a powerful story and powerful lesson, I think, for him. And it's really good that he actually listened to that. What I see is it's a lot harder with guys who are single or maybe don't have children to, you know, everybody has a motivating factor or factors, and finding that kind of golden motivation for them is always a task, but, and sometimes they just tell you, but usually it takes a while. As far as where people can find you, you have your website, DarrenIngelsND.com, DarrenIngelsND.com. And all of your social media handles are at DarrenIngelsND. And you have your book, of course, that people can buy, and that's on Amazon?
Yes.
Okay. So yeah, people can buy it online at Amazon, The Lyme Solution, a five-part plan to fight the inflammatory autoimmune response and beat Lyme disease. And I have it and I've been reading it and it's been very helpful for me. And I really, you know, I appreciate your time, and this is such a vast topic and you have a lot of knowledge and expertise, and I appreciate you coming on the podcast and sharing that with everybody. And I know this will be really helpful for a lot of people. So thanks so much for being on the show today.
Oh, well, thanks for having me, Sam.
Now here's for my mandatory disclaimer. This is a medical information podcast and is only for general information purposes. It does not substitute or constitute the practice of medicine or any medical practices, including the giving of medical advice to any individual. And please observe that no doctor-patient relationship has been formed here. This medical podcast offers health, hormone, fitness, and nutrition information and is designed for educational purposes only. You should not rely on this information as a substitution for, nor does it replace professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. If you have any concerns or questions about your health, you should always consult with a physician or other healthcare professional. Do not disregard, avoid, or delay obtaining medical or health-related advice and appropriate treatment from your healthcare professional. Users should seek the care of their physician or healthcare professional for any such conditions. The use of any information provided on this podcast is solely at your own risk. The contents and topics of this podcast have not been evaluated by the FDA nor approved by any other government or official body. The topics and content covered is not intended to diagnose, cure, or prevent any disease or disorder of any kind. Developments in medical research may impact the health, fitness, and nutritional advice that appears here on the podcast in the future episodes. No assurance can be given that the advice contained in this podcast will always include the most recent findings or developments in medicine with respect to the particular material covered. If you are in the United States and think you are having a medical or health emergency, call your healthcare professional or 911 immediately. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to hearing your feedback and looking forward to have you on future podcasts. Thank you.